In session number 8736, room number 21.
Lord Harding, tape 21. I wonder if you'd be good enough to describe in as close a detail as possible what you can remember about your part of El Alamein.
Well, I told you, my task was to launch an attack on the southern flank to hold the German, particularly the German 21st Panzer Division, down in that part. But without making my division useless for further operations by incurring heavy casualties. So it was rather a bit of a complication. However, we started off, we had the Free French Brigade who were launched against Hemmoud, which was a difficult feature with a bad approach. And the Armoured Brigade with infantry, some infantry supporting, against the minefields a little further north, with a view to breaking through there and getting to grips with the main German position. Well, we started off, and the French got a footing on Hemmoud, and then were driven back by a counterattack. Further north, in the minefields, we did get through the minefields, made a, do a passage through the outer minefields, and then started to lose tanks. And so some people said afterwards that we didn't try hard enough, but I had got this restriction on me not to incur heavy losses. So after losing a number of tanks in the minefields, I decided not to press the attack any further. That was all. This had all happened at night, on the first night of Alamein. And we remained holding the positions that we had. The French, I told to try again in the morning. And they again failed to capture Hemmoud. And so we were stuck. All along my front, we hadn't made, we hadn't broken through, and we hadn't captured Hemmoud, and that was the position for I don't know, couple of days I suppose, and then I got orders to withdraw, and move up north, and be prepared to for further action on the northern part of the front. So we withdrew from the southern flank and moved up to the north, where we were in reserve behind the front line on the northern part of the front, where the main offensive had been taken place. And there we stayed until after Operation Supercharge, which was the final breakthrough of the German front. And then I was told to go on in pursuit. And we went through the old German front with our own troops there. It was a very confused situation. And the dust and the smoke and it was very bad. We couldn't. And I thought it was going to be a terrible difficulty to keep control. However, we did. We succeeded, and my Armoured Brigade commander kept control of his brigade, and we got through, and we started off in pursuit, got out into the open. And that was a tremendous feeling, through the German front and into the open. And then we advanced, and we ran into an Italian armoured division, which we engaged for the rest of this, I think, was the second day of our operations in the north. And we fought them, drove them off, and then continued our advance forward, and I kept on getting orders to turn in and cut off the Germans on the road, but I felt it was far too soon, so I always continued to press on my axis. And then came the rain, and we were held up by the weather and shortage of petrol. And our petrol supplies failed. We ran out of our supplies, and our replenishments didn't come up. And I think there was, of course, competition between there were three divisions involved in the pursuit. There was the New Zealand division on my right, myself, my own division, and then 1st Army Division. And the competition for petrol, of course, was very severe. And we were really held up. We halted for about 24 hours, which was most unfortunate. And then we got petrol and we went on, and we then ran into a minefield by Darba, I think it was, which held us up for some time, but eventually proved to be a dummy. We got through that, got up onto the top of the escarpment again, and ran into the... I think it was 21 or 15, may have been 15 Panzer, and fought them for the rest of that day. This was about the third or fourth day of our pursuit. And then they withdrew, and we pushed on. We bypassed the brook and went straight across the desert and ran into the enemy rearguard again at Ajadabia, where we fought them. Then they withdrew, and we pushed on again to Aguila. And we were held up at Aguila by a strong German defensive position there, and reinforcements were brought up. And I got a brigade of the 51st Division put in under my command to break through there. And we attacked there and broke through that. And then we advanced, what the place was called, quite a good advance in south of, short of Tripoli, but south of Burat. And there we were halted again for supplies, and then the offensive continued. We wanted to go on our own. When we were at the bottom of the Gulf of Sirte, we thought we could go on our own. But Monty said, no, we must wait until... He was determined not to get... to allow what had happened in the two previous occasions of our having a successful offensive and then being driven back. He was absolutely determined on that, and I think he was right, as things turned out. But at that time, I thought that my division was capable of going on its own, but we weren't allowed to. However, eventually, we drove the Germans back, and we were fighting them the place called Tahuna, which is south of Tripoli, which was the last rearguard position they could hold before, without evacuating Tripoli. And that is where I was knocked off the top of my tank. Yeah, we covered about 600 miles, so we hadn't done too badly.
How did you manage to keep supplied going forward so quickly?
Well,
The
organisation worked, and forward supply depots had been established behind our own lines, but forward of LMA, and all the supplies came up by road. We were on short commons. But the main thing was petrol.
Was it a thrilling experience?
Oh, yes, wonderful.
Yes, you know, your idea when you got into the open country, this sounds as if you must have felt you were really moving at last.
Well, yes, once you break through an established position, you're in the open, and then it's all yours. It's so good enough.
Did the Germans put up a really good fight there? Was it a stiff resistance?
Oh, well, Delamain, yes. Oh, yes, it was a very tough battle. It really was what Monty called a dogfight. And, of course, the infantry in breaking through the German position. And of course, the one of which armoured brigade it was, where Vic Turner got the Victoria Cross, they had a very tough time. One of the armoured brigades was committed early on in the Operation Supercharge. But we went straight through. We didn't have any fighting until we were out in the open. So we were fortunate.
Apart from when you were held up in the beginning, in your other position.
Yes.
Was it the minefields? Were these the biggest problem, would you say?
Well, I think the combination of the minefields and the effective defence put up by the German infantry and artillery and armour. I think it was a combination of the minefields and the German battlefield efficiency.
And as you explained earlier, you felt their technology perhaps was, superior to ours.
Well, it had been, yes. I think by that time we were getting on top. But mind you, we started off the pursuit still with Crusader tanks. And we did have Grants, and then with later Shermans.
Could you tell me now about the occasion of your wounding? Where were you and what were you doing when you were wounded?
Well, I was in a hurry, you see, because it was 2.5 years that I'd been trying to get to Tripoli. And being what I am, I suppose I was in a hurry. And my leading armoured brigade was held up by German anti-tank and artillery positions at this place called Tarhuna. My plan was to overlap them on the south and try and outflank them and get on that way. It was a very rough country, very broken, hilly, desert country, wadis and nullahs and that sort of thing. So it wasn't too easy, but it was what we wanted to do was to outflank them. And the armoured brigade was fully engaged. The artillery, horse artillery regiment was deployed in action and getting a lot of dealt with by the German artillery. And we had our medium, because of the difficult going and so on, a medium regiment had not come up the same pace as the rest of the division. So they were rather little way back. And I was very anxious to get them up in order to start them off in counter-battery and neutralize the impact effect of the German artillery, which was being serious at that time, and pinning my chaps down to the ground and also knocking my artillery about. So I went up. I was working with a couple of cut-down honey tanks, taking the turrets off in order to provide the communication, put the wireless sets in and so on. I think it was my forward control was jamming my brigade, armored brigade commander's rear link. So he was held down on a small ridge. And I left my two tanks below the ridge and walked across and sat on the turret of his, sat on the outside of the turret of his tank, which was just held down, in order to discuss with him what was about, how we'd go on and what we'd best to do. I said, I'm going back now to try and hurry up the medium regiment, so we can get some really effective counter-battery work going. as I was just about to get off his tank, I noticed a new German battery that I hadn't seen before open up away to the right. And so I just put my darted up to see if I could sort of spot more or less where it was. And then crump, 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 bang, in front of where we were, a stonk. And one of the shells burst all over the tank. The brigade commander and his brigade major went down inside the turret, but I was on the outside. So I got plastered with bits of shell across my middle and legs.
Can you remember much about it?
Well, I remember sliding down the top of the tank and crawling underneath and the hope that I wouldn't get another one. And then they pulled me out, and the doctors got hold of me. They sent for the doctor, got hold of me, and I remember being very annoyed. I got a new pair of trousers. We used to wear cavalry tool trousers in those days. I just got a new pair. In fact, I got it just before we started off on that final offensive. And I was very pleased with them. And in order to get at my leg where the wounds were, they cut the thing off. So I was very annoyed about that. And then Mike Carver, who was my G1, was told about what had happened. He got onto the RAF, who said they'd send in a light an aircraft to pick me up and take me out, because by that time the doctors had told him that I wouldn't survive being evacuated by ambulance. So they cleared a strip. It's not a difficult thing to do, and there was a bit of flat ground, and they cleared a strip, and an aircraft came in under fighter cover. Then with a mobile surgical team arrived, they gave me a blood transfusion, picked me up, took me back to a field dressing station, and that's all I remember.
That plane must have been flying to its limits, was it not? It was quite a journey. Was it quite a hazardous thing to come
and
take you out?
Well, I think so, anyway. Yes, I think it was very noble of them to take it on. I mean, I don't think I was worth it. Back to a New Zealand dressing station, field dressing station. And there they were very good. I can remember it now. It was a New Zealand nurse there. Very good, excellent. And then I was evacuated by air back to Cairo, and I was in hospital there until July.
What were your wounds? Could you tell us what happened to you?
Well, I got my right leg. I got a hole. A big bit of shell hit me underneath between the knee, which tore the muscles, both the thigh muscles and both legs, and blew off three fingers of my left hand, and I've still got some bits of metal in my chest, which fortunately lodged in the ribs and don't move. So that was pretty well. They wrecked me off anyway. So I fell into hands of very good surgeons, and I recovered. So I was very fortunate. Well, it's wonderful. You know, the medical service is wonderful. The surgeons and nurses, the whole organization is marvelous. I went to, 15th General? Yes, 15th General Hospital outside Cairo. And my most vivid recollection of that time is that I was still on my back and unable to walk, when I got a message to say that Monty had said that he was coming out and wanted to see me. And I thought that I knew I knew enough about what was going on to know that at that time they were busy planning the invasion of Sicily. And I thought, you know, he'd be frightfully busy. He would come out and just pass the time of day and say, "Hello, John, how are you?" and that sort of thing, and try and cheer me up. And that was all, but not a bit of it. He came out, he pulled up a chair, sat down beside my bed, sent his ADC away on some job or other, and spent an hour or more telling me about everything that had happened since I had been knocked out. About his plans for the future. And even after that, I've still got his letters, of course, which he wrote me, in which he took tremendous interest and told me that once I was fit, I could count on him to give me a good job. So I always dispute the people who say that Monty was entirely lacking in compassion. As far as I personally was concerned, he showed great compassion and tremendous help and interest.
Did you go back to work with him ever, or were you then in different theatres once you
No, I didn't work with him again until after the war, when he was CIJS. And I was commanding, Southern Command, I think. I didn't work with him again until then. No, he came out of Italy once when I was there, before I became CID, before I went to Southern Command. No, I didn't, I wasn't there. I'd never served under his command again until he was CIJS and I was commanding, one of his commanders in chief.
Could I ask you a little about the sort of life your soldiers would be living in the desert in World War II compared with the conditions in World War I? Now, I know that the deserts were quite different, Palestine to North Africa, but do you think that their living conditions, nonetheless, had improved so much from World War
I? Oh, yes, very much so. Oh, very much so. And you see... I didn't serve in any trench warfare except to a limited extent in Gallipoli and Gaza. So I can't really compare them with those horrible, terrible conditions. But in the Western Desert in the Second World War, the thing was much more open. You weren't stuffed into trenches. You weren't compressed into areas. You had a great deal of freedom of movement, and you had good supplies. And the whole business was that people became very independent in regard to their supplies. They got their food. But when you were in the pursuit from Elamain, when you stopped to brew up, as we called it, you made tea and you had my driver. I always had a couple of tins of McConaughey wired onto the exhaust of his vehicle, which had whatever it was. So you could always get a bit of hot food anyway. Oh no, the living conditions were much better. What was trying, of course, was that you didn't have all that amount of water. You had much more water than we did have in Gallipoli. But you didn't have all that amount of water. And various ways were devised for making the utmost use of water. I mean, we used to use our waterproof sheets, for example, to make a succession of paths and channels at the top of a mala, so that and then you would run, you'd use that for washing in, and you could have a sort of stand-up wash in that, and then run the water off through a sieve into a container below and use the water all over again. You learned to conserve your water, but you didn't have unlimited water. It was restricted. But the food, you no longer lived on bully beef and biscuits. You got some fresh meat sometimes. You were nearly always able, but certainly in armored formations, you were able to cook a decent meal once at one time during the day. It might be in the evening, it might be sometime in the middle of the day. And the food was all right. But the trouble, the horrible thing, I think, in the desert was the Khamsin, the hot south wind, which comes sort of March till June and blows. And the Arabs have a saying that if the Khamsin blows for 2 days, a man is entitled to beat his wife. If it blows for 5 days, he's entitled to murder her. So, I mean, that gives you some idea of what the wind means. That's on the dust and the dust storm. The south wind, Hamstein brings the dust, hot dust storms, and that really is very trying. But, and the other thing were desert salt. I was very lucky. I didn't have them badly. I had them once, and you get them on your hands, and your, well, some people get them all over their body, and they do take, they're very depressing things. And
what are they caused by, do you think?
I think they're a blood condition. They're probably caused by lack of vitamins, probably not enough lime juice or something like that. No, I think it's a blood condition.
Were you given vitamin pills in the Second World War in the desert?
I don't remember. Did we have anti-malaria? Well, Pinsy, yes. Yes, no, yes. What, we had some pills. What on earth were they called? I think they were vitamins, yes. Yes, but the thing you had to avoid were those sort of pep pills. One brigadier gave his, they were all right for 24 hours, but after that everybody fell asleep. And I think he got the sack because he overdosed his brigade of them.
Do you think you all kept relatively fit in the desert?
Well, either you kept very fit, or you were sick. You got, there was quite a lot of jaundice. But, no, I personally kept very well, except for one year I had bad desert sores, but not incapacitating. But jaundice was a serious complaint. But on the whole, I think the general standard of health was good, and the medical treatment was excellent. I mean, the casualty evacuation arrangements were good, and I would say that vast improvements on the First World War.
Would you have had stages of medical care, with the campaigns? Would you have had the sort of forward dress stations and then the casualty clearing stations?
Well, you had your own medical officer, your medical orderlies, in your unit. And you had them at your headquarters. And then you had the field ambulances, which dealt with immediately with casualties and evacuation. And then there were the casualty clearing stations, and behind them were the general hospitals. I would have said it's as good a setup as you could have had.
That must be important for morale.
Oh, very.
Would you say?
Well, it's terribly important that every soldier should know that if he gets knocked out, that he gets proper and prompt medical attention.
Well, you certainly did, Lord Hardinge.
Well,
didn't
I was
you?
Lucky. I would better off than a great many. But no, I think on the whole, it was very good. I don't know, the medical records will show, of course. I doubt very much if lives were unnecessarily lost through bad medical attention or organization. I doubt it.